when an inexperienced coach or an inexperienced student learns in a very particular way without understanding the larger context of why these teachings are the way they are, then it can become this kind of rarefied, well, this is the way I learned it, and so this is the way it needs to be done, rather than recognizing that those techniques actually have their origins in really task-specific goals that we have to keep in mind.
Ready, up!
Right, this is a long one, y'all. I wanted to release this episode after the most recent episode with Greg Lehman because Adam and I take the discussion of proper techniques' impact on circus and aerial training and performing just a little bit further. We discuss the effects of proper technique on circus as a creative and expressive art form and on us as the practitioner. We touch on some of the ways linear learning using an ideal movement template, example, a straight line like the other handstand, as the primary task goal can inhibit both technical and creative growth of the circus learner or practitioner, among so much more. Among other things, here are a few short plugs. I really do want to shout out Adam's offerings, their sliding scale, and he is offering an online workshop this March along with his prior online offerings. On top of that, I have said it once and I'll say it again, there is no city like Montreal during the Complete Mont Cirque Festival, and so I truly am thrilled to be teaming up with the Académie de Cirque de Montréal to offer a 5-day aerial straps lab. It'll be a full half day of instruction, exploration, and coaching in the morning, and it'll leave you plenty of time for relaxing and picnicking in the afternoon before an evening full of any number of world-class shows. More than anything, with the folks who have signed up already, it is going to be an incredible community of aerialists from all over being strapped badasses in one huge aerial studio together. For both of Adam's and my little plugs, you can check out the show notes for links or go to the links in our Instagram bios. All right, on to the episode.
Welcome to Cirque Sci. Hi, Adam. It's really awesome to have you on. And at this point, we have crossed paths both in terms of geographic location, work. I was your baby intern for a little tiny brief period of time with the safety committee, and we've also trained in the same spaces. So just for reference for everyone who doesn't know Adam Woolley, Adam has been in circus since 2008. He has a Tumblr all about circus pedagogy and training that is a third as old as I am. He was the safety committee chair for the American Circus Educators Association. He has done a bachelor's in directing for theater, applied health sciences for his master's, and who knows, maybe a greater, longer academic endeavor is on the horizon. Currently, Adam is injecting his incredible perspectives into the coaching and teaching spaces online, all about how to incorporate the things that are maybe missing from a lot of modern day circus training and circus dialogue, not everywhere, but in a lot of spaces. And so today we're going to get into some of that pedagogical nerdery. So Adam, thank you for hopping on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was pretty good. Yeah, that was a pretty good intro. I feel like you mentioned the little baby internship, and I remember that. I remember little 21-year-old Aaron when I first met him. You know, I was only 26 at the time, but 26 to 21, you know, I was like, oh yeah, it's so great to like just watch people grow up through circus, right? And to see what everybody ends up doing, and to see, God, how amazing people's technique and teaching become as we kind of all get older
and change. And I think as a 21-year-old, I was like, man, this 26-year-old like knows so much about circus. And 5 years, even though it's not that long in the scope of some folks' lives, it is a huge amount of knowledge and experience that I for sure didn't have. And I think it's clear that those years, not just those 5 years, but just the years that you have spent thinking about circus have really allowed you to build a nuanced system for approaching how you have those conversations with your students and also with your coaches.
In 2015, we met in New York and we had some experience training together and teaching and stuff at Circus Warehouse, you know, rest in peace, beautiful New York space. But in 2015, I moved to Philadelphia as the head coach of the Philadelphia School of Circus Arts. And between 2015 and I'd say 2022, I really was in charge of the pedagogical approach and content and teacher training at that space. So I really had a dreamy situation where I had, you know, like 600 to 800 students a week coming through a recreational and pre-professional program that really was both mine to do the teacher training for and mine to kind of set the culture for. And that was a really incredible experience that I am just so grateful for. But the bulk of my work, I think, was really using that space as a lab. Like, I had this great 7-year experiment with real kids as young as 4 and like real adult recreationalists and real serious adults and real serious teenagers. And really got to play with both my own pedagogical approach to circus and with how I gave it to teachers.
And I think your lab condensed version into the social media sphere has already had an impact in terms of provoking, not in a bad way, but instigating dialogue between people. I mean, even between you and I think part of my day job is performance optimization coach, and our perspectives have allowed for some really interesting conversation where I think you have challenged me, not in a bad way, to think more broadly and to think beyond kind of the scope of like, all right, we need to acquire this skill in the most optimal path possible.
I love that you switched to bro voice to do that, because that's exactly like that's the vibe. Like, we're going to get the skill. We're going to do the thing exactly perfectly, right? And I feel like that...
Got to make those gains.
Right, got to make those gains, bruh. And you know, I wonder if we can keep that voice, but also be like, man, treat yourself gently, bruh, right? Like, take those rest days, bruh. Like, can we start to put some of that vibe out into the internet land?
Like, have you considered a process goal, bruh?
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, yeah. I wonder if we can get that out there. I feel like I'm seeing that vibe start to propagate through sections of the internet and in some exciting different communities, you know? I think that circus has a lot of kin with I think where circus connects with things like parkour, where circus connects with things like soft acro, where circus connects with things like pole fitness. I think these are all really interesting intersections. You know, circus connects with juggling, circus connects with so many of these different disciplines. And I've always hoped that circus culture, that circus's kind of focus on creativity, that circus's focus on personal development would kind of osmose out into these other disciplines. And I hope I see that. I see it sometimes, but I also see these other disciplines osmosing into circus with other things like perfectionism and right ways to do things that I don't love as much, that I hope to keep out of circus. Like, let's push the good stuff out, but keep the filters up for...
One thing that inevitably is happening, which is fair, is a lot of really highly trained dancers realize they can get paid more doing aerial than they can dancing, and dancing way harder. Like, I've been on contracts where the dancers were paid way less and were working way harder. And if they're like, oh, I can take my background and apply it quickly to this thing, but they've got the culture of ballet, it's going to osmose that direction for sure.
Absolutely. And I saw this a lot when I was working in New York for Circus Warehouse, for myself, where a good... some during periods of my career, a good chunk of my job was kind of being the guy that trained dancers to do aerials, and also tried in a sly way to tell them that they should be getting paid a whole lot more for what they're doing now than they were, you know? Like, I felt really lucky to slide into New York right as kind of the corporate aerialist scene there was really falling apart, according to my mentors, to the people who were teaching me. They were like, oh, I used to get paid you know, like $3,000 a night for this. And I was like, oh man, I'm only making 1500. And then 3 years later, I was like, oh man, I'm only making 200.
With the cost of living going up as much as it has, it's an inverse relationship. The more your spinach costs at the grocery store, the less you're going to get paid for that like nightly gig.
Exactly, exactly. I think that inverse relationship is really proven true. And I think it's really beautiful that everyone's interest in the disciplines of circus have expanded so much over the past 10 or 15 years. And I think the internet has a lot to do with that. I think the accessibility of the circus disciplines has changed a lot over the past 15 years. You know, when I started in 2005, I was like going on dial-up internet to search like Circus School United States. And there were like 3 hits. And now, you know, it's like hashtag Ariel Silks for Life or whatever. It's circus every damn day or whatever the hashtag is on Instagram. And you can just get all of it. You know, the access to what at one time was really privileged information has just exploded.
One of my first Straps coaches, he learned by emailing a Straps student or Straps coach now, but someone who was a student at ENC. He emailed that student and was like, hey, like, I don't live in Canada, but can you teach me Straps over email? And now it's like, cool, I can just search Straps on Instagram or TikTok and have the world as my oyster. Going back to how other disciplines have osmosed into circus, I would love to take that framework and apply it to how maybe gymnastics has osmosed into circus handstand training.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was actually listening to your last episode. Anyone who's listening to this one, you should definitely go back, listen to that last one. Because something that your guest said was, oh, I think gymnastics has really, you know, influenced circus. And I really think that gymnastics is, or circus comes from gymnastics. And my history brain immediately perked up and I went like, oh, no, actually, it's actually completely the opposite, you know? How old is USAG? How old is organized competitive gymnastics in the world? It's actually quite young, right? Ringling Brothers by itself has a 150, 170-year history in the United States, something like that. Don't quote me. Someone go look it up. And Ringling was really only the latest iteration of what is a many, many, many hundreds, if not thousands of year history of acrobatics and by extension, all of the rest of the disciplines that constitute modern circus, right? And so gymnastics, competitive gymnastics is really just a sportification of a set of acrobatic skills that kind of emerged from what are really oral traditions, right? That are what are really movement traditions that have been passed down however they've been passed down through families, through traditional schools, like somehow we've all learned back handspring. We all know back handspring exists. We all know handstand exists, right? And what competitive sports has done is really just applied a code of points to that, is just said, if you want to compete in our sport, then we have to score you. We have to evaluate you in comparison to other people in a really specific way. And we have to decide what that code of points is. And, you know, like if you look at the gymnastics code of points over the past 70 years, not only has it transformed hugely in like inconceivable ways, but even the way that they score has changed. I remember watching the Olympics when I was a kid, and in gymnastics, there was this thing called the perfect 10, right? That gymnastics could shoot for. And a few years back, they opened up the code of points. So it's no longer, you know, like a score out of 10. It's now a cumulative score based on technical criteria. And so the score now can go up beyond 10. But the point is that everything that we know or think we know about tumbling or about the technique is it kind of revolves around this code of points. And the trickle-down effect of this codification, of this sportification into the most base levels of teachers' pedagogy is huge. There's a huge impact that has because one Olympic sport says, you know, this is how we're going to score a handstand. All of the sudden, all of the rest of us have to look like a very particular thing or execute skills in a very particular
100%.
Way.
Even just within gymnastics, there was a point when the point in time when banana handstands were the gymnastic standard.
Right. And why do you think that is? Why do you think it was that banana handstands might have been like the starting place for handstand technique?
I don't know. Are they easier to hold that way? Could be. Could
Because they're much easier to hold. Because when you don't know how to do a handstand, a banana back handstand is the easiest handstand for most people to actually balance, right? And I feel like that has become some sort of like great mystery, or somehow that's some huge countercultural thing when we say it, because there are all these handstanders on Instagram, online, who are all like teaching people this one perfect straight line. And you know, I love teaching handstands. I've taught handstands my whole career, and I love teaching the straight line. I love it when someone achieves the straight line. But would I ever pretend that that's the easiest position for someone to balance in? Like, no, it's just not. It's not the easiest position to balance in. It's not even necessarily the quote unquote best alignment. It's not even necessarily like healthier for you or less healthy for you. Like, we can't say anything about that, you know?
It's not even the most interesting to look at. Like a straight handstand, if you perform that in a circus show, like I will be bored very quickly.
Exactly.
There are so many positions that are a lot more interesting, or even fluid positions where you're moving between things that are, you know, micro adjustments instead of just like rock solid.
Right. And so we these kind of cultural myths are created through processes like the one that we're describing, right? So we've described a process where oral traditions, like deep, very, very old kind of circus traditions that are passed down through families or passed down from teachers to athletes or teachers to artists, move towards a sport. And then the sport decides, you know, here's how we're going to evaluate people. And then since the sport is Olympic, it stretches all around the world. And so all of a sudden, the movement template that's being kind of idealized by a sport becomes the movement template that everyone thinks they have to achieve. And so then that trickles all the way down to like the recreational gymnastics class that your four-year-old, you know, daughter or son is going to take, right? All of a sudden, right, or in your yoga class. All of a sudden, you're in a yoga class or you're you know, like, taking something for fun, and someone's like, you have to point your toes and straighten your legs. And what is that actually doing? What is the enforcement of this ideal movement template actually doing, both to the teachers and to their students, and to an art form, a performance art form, or a self-expressive like journey of self-discovery, like circus? What is that doing to us psychologically? What is that doing to us spiritually? What is that doing to us, you know, psychically?
And physically,
right? Yeah, of course, right? And also like injuries, right? Like, what does it do to us as circus artists or circus coaches when those boundaries are placed on a movement form that for me is either about performance and communication or about like self-discovery, right? Or about an inner journey that people are taking with themselves to discover what they can do, to discover, you know, where the limits aren't.
When you have a circus coach or a yoga instructor applying the gymnastic standard to learning a handstand, you run into a lot of people believing that there are certain check boxes they have to hit before they can move on to the next part of exploring learning a handstand. And even just like on a base level, let's say someone's like, oh, I want to, I don't know, work on my press handstand or something. But they believe, because they've been told this by a handstand coach, that, oh, actually, until you can hold a straight handstand, you don't get to work on presses, then they might never start exploring that next thing that might be really fun for them or allow them a lot of creative freedom or just feel better as an entrance.
Or even improve their rate of progress on the straight body handstand. You know, like one of the primary tools that I use when I'm teaching a straight body handstand is like going to a banana back handstand and moving out of it to a straight body handstand, and then moving from a straight body handstand into a small hollow back, and then moving through the straight body handstand through a small planche, right? Like, because not everyone's shoulder flexibility, not everyone's hip flexibility, not everyone's anything is going to be able to accomplish this straight line from the beginning. But what everyone can accomplish is developing a sense of awareness about what it means to move your shoulders in relation to your wrists, what it means to adjust the angle of your torso in relation to your shoulder, what it means to change your gaze as you're moving through your handstand. Like, all of these things actually develop the skill of balancing on your hands better and faster, ironically, better and faster than just drilling in this one shape as if it is some sort of like key to unlocking the world of handstands.
So would you agree that straight body, legs together, straight line handstand is maybe one of the worst ways to train handstands to build overall expertise?
I don't think I'd agree that any one handstand position is a better or worse position for training handstand. I don't want to demonize the straight body handstand. It's beautiful, right? But it's not achievable for everyone. And it's not really necessary for even professional level performance. You know, I work handstand and contortion are two of the things that I teach up through professional levels. And I work with a lot of contortionists. And for someone who has as much range of motion as a contortionist, you know, real professional contortionists, choosing the straight body line out of the literally thousands of options that they have, you know, like, where do I put this part? 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 It is extraordinarily difficult for them, you know? And so in one sense, I worked on straight body handstand with a lot of my contortion students because developing the awareness of, yeah, where are all the parts? Where are all the things that you have to learn to adjust? Straight body gives us a fun tool for that. But at the end of the day, like, if you ask some of these professional contortion hand balancers to do a straight body handstand, a lot of them, a lot of the ones who I know will low key kind of like roll their eyes and go like, ugh, well, sure, fine, I guess, like, okay, but my head sticks out, or like, okay, but my ribs don't come all the way in. You know, it's they recognize because of their level of expertise in other things that this one thing is just another skill.
For sure. And it's not to say that, you know, like the other straight body handstand is a bad handstand. It really, really helps. For example, if you're training Benkin, if you're doing or partner acro, and you're able to be one point over your bases, or you're kind of all over the place and you're twisting through the air, one point is a lot easier to deal with than all over the place. It's more to say that if the goal, or in your words, the task goal, is to balance on your hands, the straight line, legs together, handstand is not necessarily the goal that people should be aiming for right at the gate. If they want to and they have reasons to and it helps them, for sure. But if it's like, this is the archetypal handstand that you should be trying to hit every time you handstand, there are a lot more ways that they could still balance on their hands safely while learning a lot of other things about how to adjust the variables in a handstand.
Absolutely. And you're hitting on two things that I think are both really important. One of them is task orientation, right? What are we trying to do, right? And we'll see this a lot in different techniques for entering a handstand or different techniques for how, for example, sports acrobatics and gymnastics approach teaching handstand a little bit differently. Because in gymnastics, you're primarily learning a handstand as a position to pass through as you're tumbling, right? And so the goal of, you know, like a lot of gymnastics pedagogical approaches, like we're going to make a T, we're going to stand with our arms overhead, we're going to pass through a perfect T position, we're going to reach our arms well out in front of us, and then our whole body like a board is going to come up. You know, this is kind of the traditional progressions that you see for handstand on USAG and things. And this is a great way to teach handstand for someone who's going to learn a front handspring, for someone who's going to learn a back handspring, because they have to pass quickly into and through a position like this, right? But in sports acrobatics, you see a lot more training of the press from a lot earlier on, an emphasis on kick, straddle, pike from standing positions with your hands and feet as close together as they can be. Because in sports acro, you're training the handstand for a flyer who's going to be taking off from someone's shoulders, right? But when But when an inexperienced coach or an inexperienced student learns in a very particular way without understanding the larger context of why these teachings are the way they are, then it can become this kind of rarefied, well, this is the way I learned it, and so this is the way it needs to be done, rather than recognizing that those techniques actually have their origins in really task-specific goals that we have to keep in mind. I think the other thing that you started to touch on was the, like, you know, when we're doing Bankine or something, the straight line is really helpful. And that begins to touch on parts of risk assessment, you know? What is it, you know, like, oh, we're going to enter a handstand this way, or we're going to perform this skill in this way because that makes it safer, because that mitigates the risk of doing this thing. You know, if someone is in a banana back handstand doing hand-to-hand, is that riskier?
I hear where you're going, and let's definitely unpack that more. I think there's a way that there's an understanding that, like, if I'm moving this through space, at least for my puny motor skill calculations, I have a better sense of where it's probably going to be if it's solid and stable. Whereas if I have a juggling club that is changing its positioning, like it's bending in half as it's rotating, it's probably a little bit harder for me to catch. And I don't necessarily think that's not going to influence risk assessment. But if you were like, hey, is doing hand-to-hand with banana back handstand riskier? I would say probably not.
Yeah. And I think I'd agree. The way I'd, you know, it's funny, I learned so much. So I remember a piece of our history together is when in like 2013 to 2015, when I was the chair of the American Circus Educators Safety Committee, my task as the chair of that committee was to create a national set of safety guidelines and then a program for studios to be recognized for good risk management practices, right? My primary role was like facilitating the meetings where experts got together and argued about what these guidelines should look like and what should be in them, you know? Anyone who's listening who hasn't heard of the American Circus Educators Safety Program, you should absolutely check it out. Simple Google search. It's an incredible program. It's an incredible program that both comes into spaces to provide consultations from like real risk management experts. And I learned so much through that process of creating that program and facilitating those meetings about what we mean when we talk about safety and what we mean when we talk about risk assessment and what good risk assessment actually looks like, as opposed to kind of a performative risk assessment. So I would say, for example, if we were to look at aerial inversions as a skill, and we're performing a risk assessment on the process of learning this skill, right? We could also look at banana back handstands and hand-to-hand. But in either of these examples, performative risk assessment looks like the safest way to do this skill is XYZ, and therefore I need to enforce the quote-unquote safest way to do this skill on all of my students. A student who, for example, can't support their body weight, you know, like in this quote-unquote biomechanically ideal position, end quote, shouldn't be turning upside down at all. Or a perfect straddle-up position looks like this, right? All of these are kind of like ways that performative risk assessment can be used to enforce what are really just ideal or preferred movement templates, right? Now, this is not to say that all positions are created equal in terms of risk. It's to say that some risk assessment is performative. When we're not actually going through the process of who is standing in front of me, what's their history, what's their strength, what's their level of experience, what's their level of coordination, right? Can I spot them safely? Have they ever turned upside down in their life before, right? Actual risk assessment is a process that happens really deeply contextually. And it's quite easy to actually shortcut that process by taking ideal movement templates and saying things must be done in this way because this is the safe way.
A lot of those ideal movement templates, I think, you know, come from ballet, come from gymnastics, come from the KPM or like kinesiopathological model from physical therapy and biomechanics, where it's like, oh, if your joint moves in this different way, it will break and you will die. But a lot of that from the KPM model has evolved. We know that soft tissues have a lot more adaptive capacity than we thought, ligaments, tendons, etc. And we also know that there's a huge capacity for people to adapt to a new way of moving. So as an example, straddle inversion, that's how you do it. You lift your legs, you curl your spine, you hop your hips up, you stack your spine at the top, etc. That is not the easiest way for some people. Some people who are super bendy in their back and strong in their shoulders might just do like a scorpion lat pressy invert where they're totally arched the whole time. Is one of those safer than the other? No, they're both relatively safe depending on the context of the person, as you said.
Well, and I think it's really interesting. I'm going to rewind just a moment to something that stood out to me about what you said, is kind of like, where do these templates come from? They come from ballet, they come from these other places. Sure, ultimately, I agree with you, but proximally, rather than ultimately, they come from us. They come from me. They come from you. We're the coaches. We're the people actually coaching the people who are doing the circus, you know? And that's to me, a really important step that oftentimes gets skipped when we do this talking. It's kind of like, oh, well, sure, I understand that. But then you go back to your class and you teach them a straddle up, you know, because that's just what we do, because that's what's ingrained. And this was what I mean as kind of part of the really interesting experiment over 6 or 7 years that I kind of got to engage in, at the Philadelphia School of Circus Arts, was what does it mean to kind of undo some of those preconceptions? You know, what does it mean to focus on like task orientation? What does it mean to have levels that are like kind of dynamically created, right? What does it mean to blur the edges between some of these things? What does it mean to engage in student assessment or risk assessment that actually involves the student? This was another principle of risk assessment that really stuck with me and influenced my pedagogy, was the idea that more eyes, the more knowledgeable eyes you have in a risk situation, the less risky the situation becomes, right? Because mistakes are going to happen, because the primary thing at the bottom of risk management is that accidents are inevitable, right? It's all just about inevitability. And so the more people in the room know what the rigging is supposed to look like, the more people in the room know what safe behavior looks like, the more people in the room understand kind of how to judge the height of, say, a double star drop, the less risk everyone is in. And so what does it mean to really meaningfully begin to include students in their own risk assessment process? What does it mean to do that with 6-year-olds? What does it mean to do that with 10-year-olds? What does it mean to do that with 15-year-olds? What does it mean to do that with 25-year-olds, with 40-year-olds? What does it mean to have, you know, like a 50-year-old recreational aerialist really actually know how to recognize tricks they can and can't do that day for that shoulder? It really changed my perspective on a lot of those things, and then gave me kind of a lab on which to work with some of that stuff. And I think we as coaches, not I, because I agree with you about what are the things that influence us outside, but at the end of the day, it's circus coaches, it's us, it's the people who are teaching these things that need to open up and change not only how we're teaching these things, but to challenge the way our students are coming in thinking about these things. They come in, and as a straps example, they want to be able to do a side flag, right? What does it mean to be able to do a side flag even? You know, they come in with this request. It means they want to look like the person on Instagram, right? It means they want to look like a particular thing. They want to find out if they can do this XYZ thing. And I think we as coaches have a responsibility, if you want to shepherd this kind of special circus thing that I think we have a responsibility to challenge our students sometimes. And that can be hard because it involves challenging your own preconceived notions about what a skill is and challenging your students' notions of what a skill is. And that can be really scary and that can be really tricky. And it can also, you know, threaten your livelihood, because students don't like to be challenged in this way.
There's a lot to unpack there. One, what a skill is, and then two, how to talk about that with your audience, your students, etc. And going almost back to where it's all coming from. It's coming from those other athletic disciplines. It's coming from ourselves. And then we also have, in the online space, a bunch of physical therapists who specialize in aerial and circus who will say that you should be doing something this way. And it's in the interest of empowering all of their audience members, which I think is really good, right? Like, we want people to learn about their bodies. We want people to learn, hey, here's what okay pain feels like, you know, muscle bruise, etc. Here's what some fiery shooting tingling nerve pain feels like, and that's maybe something that you should listen to a little bit differently. But we still have within that a group of voices, including our own, that are probably very frequently unintentionally providing information to the circus learner, athlete, professional about what is or is not safe, that is at least some portion of the time inaccurate and misrepresenting what is actually risky versus what is not risky.
Yeah. And you know, this is, I think you bring up a really good point. And so I'll share my own kind of changing and evolving practice around this, right? Because definitely throughout my life, I'm kind of constantly changing how I interact with things like this, right? One of the things that I use now as one of my tools for risk assessment is sharing my own, like, feelings, emotions, sensations, and judgments about what a student is doing kind of with the student, right? I'll say things like, the way you're doing that is making me really nervous, right? Now, this doesn't contain any judgment about the way that they're doing it necessarily, right? There's no, you're doing it wrong. There's the way that you're doing this thing is making me nervous, right? I am afraid for you. I am nervous about you. I'm nervous about your safety, or I'm nervous about whatever, right? It begins by focusing kind of on myself at that moment. I'll take a fun example with like 10-year-olds doing back tucks or front tucks, right? When a 10-year-old is doing a back tuck, there can definitely be moments where I'm like, oh, that's making me really nervous, right? And so it becomes understood that in our kind of mutual designing of what learning a back tuck looks like, it's important that we both feel good. You know, safety is a feeling. Safety is a feeling. Risk is a thing that exists in the world, but safety is a feeling. I don't feel safe when this 10-year-old is doing the back tuck in this way. So I tell them that. I don't feel safe with how you're doing this. I don't feel okay. I feel too nervous. And then I offer an alternative. Like, will you show me this thing? This thing wouldn't make me uncomfortable. Can you do it this way? Right? Can you do it this way? Can you do it this way? But this is really specific to how risk is interacting with motor development, right? Rather than directing that motor development in a specific way, right? Do I need their knees to be together in a back tuck? No, I don't need their knees to be together. For some people, it's way easier to put their knees to the outside. Great, put your knees to the outside. Great, flex your feet. I'm nervous because you're throwing your head back, right? That's making me nervous because that is increasing risk in a way that I'm not okay with yet. You know, because if you just eat it, I want you to eat it onto the back of your head, not the third, like, front of your face landing, you know?
100%. There is no perfect technique, but there is a safer technique that allows you to jump high enough, to rotate enough, to not face plant.
Yeah, there are bounds. There are bounds to what is a solution to your movement task, right? That will keep you safe, both in a like immediate sense of not landing on your face, and in kind of a chronic sense of like, if you're always landing on your heels, that's going to hurt you eventually, right? That might not hurt you this time. It might not hurt you next time, but it is a higher risk way to do the thing. I want you to land on your toes because that's a lower risk way to do the thing, right? So I think there's some nuance to how these things get applied. And I think that is where some people drop off, is when we form into two camps, one which says this is exactly the right way to do things, and one which says every way is an okay to, way to do things. Then people are forced to choose which of these camps they're a part of, right? And if you're in the every way of doing something is okay camp, that's as indefensible as the camp that says there's only one way to do things. Neither of those is true, right? The solution space for any given movement task has to include considerations of both the kind of immediate and chronic risks of doing things in certain ways. You know, could I do a dislock on straps tomorrow? Like, yeah, I could, but I shouldn't.
Probably it's not worth it. But yeah, I think we're never going to be able to ignore physics and, you know, extreme levels of force generation for acute movements, or maybe for really low levels of force for repeated movements. I think what gets tricky is when that space is blurrier between what those actual risks are. For a back tuck, it is very clear. If you land on your face, it's going to hurt. If you land on your neck, it's probably going to hurt. But if you rotate around and land on your feet, there are a bunch of ways you could do that where it would be fine. It might not be aesthetically the way that someone expects you to. You might do it more tricking style, b-boy style, gymnast style, etc. But you can do it. But I think with a lot of aerial movements and even handstand form, there are people and beliefs that are held where something that is seen as integral to the safety of that movement is actually not.
I think that that is often used as a bit of a bludgeon that ends up, that the end result of our deep concern for the need to create surplus safety in aerial actually ends up limiting our creative options. It ends up limiting the ways that we teach people aerial, right? It ends up limiting the options that students think they have in aerial, and is maybe somewhat a result of like the rapid expansion and growth that aerial has been through in the past 15 years. You know, like, I get it. I would rather have people teaching a really, really strict, there's only one way to do things and this is how it's done. I'd rather have people teaching that way than people getting hurt as we go through this kind of rapid expansion process. Sure, I understand that. I was a part of that. The reason we have a safety program at all is because in 2013, there were concerns from the largest national organizations that aerial was spreading too fast and that specifically rigging, but also teaching practices were propagating in ways that weren't safe, you know, that we were going to see critically injured people in the recreational community. And as far as I know, we didn't see it on any sort of scale that we were afraid of, right? And I think the safety program played some role in that, at least. But I also think that that at this point, as the rapid growth starts to slow down, as the mainstreaming of aerial arts is winding down-ish, right? Like, this is about as mainstream as it's going to become in terms of a recreational activity. There's a really critical moment where we need to let up on the reins and bring some of the circus back in, right? And let it become more of a place where people develop self-expression, more of a place where communities take ownership of the art of the thing, where student showcases are places where people come and get their self-expression, get their creative movement, get their things, not judge themselves based on whether or not they executed their act as well as, you know, the other person did, right? Because the other person danced for years and has quote unquote beautiful lines and like blah, 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 blah. Like, I just want to, you know, groan as I say it. Like, but this is what happens when something goes through that process, is we begin to center and value sort of the wrong things. And I think it is, if it ever was time to pull as hard back on the reins as we did, it is now time to let them go. I'm not sure we ever should have pulled back so hard.
I think the safety program came from a really smart place of wanting to reduce the risk of something becoming mainstream and then a lot of like news stories coming out of like person fell on their head and died doing aerial silks, because that's not good for anyone. And as far as I can tell, it, like you said, mostly didn't really happen. There are still freak accidents, and there are still times when someone's doing a kamikaze drop or something, and then something horrible happens. But in a lot of instances, people, even kids, obviously not all kids and not all people, because we're all stupid sometimes, or low on impulse and motor control choices sometimes, but most of us want to not get hurt. Some of us more or less so than others, but a lot of the times I'm not going to make a choice that feels unsafe for me without having a safety committee being there. That doesn't mean that the safety committee doesn't need to help with rigging, because that's a whole nother story. But from an individual learner perspective, people, like you've experienced this, I'm sure, most people, hopefully, in a good coaching environment will say, hey, I don't feel comfortable trying this next progression yet. When we're looking at skill construction, using your words, how and unweighting the task goal from all the extraneous things of straight lines, pointing your toes, you know, the idealized movement template, how do we start constructing skills in a way that dials back that performative risk assessment and adds that creativity back in?
I think there is not just one answer to that question. You know, I think that all pedagogical approaches, right? Just the fancy way of saying like what you do when you're in the classroom and there are students standing there in front of you, looking at you expectantly, waiting for you to say or do something, right? I think all of those approaches at the end of the day come from a place of being rooted in some beliefs about how learning occurs and being rooted in some values around what that learning is meant to be or look like, right? And I wrote about this, I've been doing, for some of my online work, I've been writing monthly essays, and I wrote about this in my last essay, which is, I think that there's some really actually deep work to be done among circus coaches and other movement professionals on unpacking a little bit what your value system is and on what your beliefs about how learning occurs are. And then comparing in a really kind of no holds barred sort of way, comparing your value system and your beliefs about how learning occurs to how you teach, to what you actually do and say when you're in that moment with the students just kind of staring up at you, waiting for the next thing to happen. You know, do you jump on the apparatus yourself and show them the thing? Do you pose a question to them? Do you tell them what to do? Do you ask them what to do? Do you lead a warm-up? You know, like, I think there are lots of ways to approach adding variability and it's like fun, quirky sister creativity into what aerial classes look like. And I don't think any one of those approaches is necessarily better than any other, because I don't think that, you know, creativity or variability is necessarily attached to, let's say, an inquiry-based approach, right? So if I'm a teacher and I want to use inquiry in my teaching, I'll do things like, how is everyone feeling today, right? What part of our body should we start by warming up? Or one could say that telling a student to warm up their shoulders in whatever way feels good to them, right? There's kind of inquiry or student-centric approaches. But I don't actually think that variability is and creativity are predicated on student-centric approaches. If you want to lead your class because your class expects to be led, right, you can still have a teacher-centric teaching style and approach and incorporate variability and creativity, right? You can still, by telling students, right, we're going to work on our bent leg invert today, make it a thing. You know, we're going to work on our flexed feet today. We're going to work on our banana back handstand today, right? Removing the default layer from your teaching. You know, we're going to work on side flags with our knees bent. We're going to work on side flags with flexed feet. We're going to work on beats with, you know, our head in XYZ position. Incorporating variability and its quirky sister creativity doesn't have to dictate your teaching style, right? And I think that's a misconception that a lot of people have, which is like, oh, but my students really like my teaching style and I'm a successful teacher. I don't want to change my teaching style. And so I can't incorporate expressive movement or creativity. And I'm just kind of like, no, I don't actually think that's the case, right? I think it's okay if you want to keep your teaching style. I'm not judgmental about different teaching styles.
With variability, we're talking, in this instance, intentional variability, because I think we've both acknowledged that there's built-in variability literally every single time you come and do the same movement. It's never going to happen the same way twice, ever. That, to me, feels like something that can happen irrespective of teaching style. Creativity, if you don't learn creativity as a skill, and it's not something you've practiced, that seems like something that is almost harder to teach regardless of teaching style, because you're maybe teaching from like a mathematical perspective. And like, I have a math friend or a friend who is a math PhD, and I bet he would say like math is really creative. So maybe that's not the right idea, but anything can be creative to some extent. But how do we, if we're maybe a coach who doesn't feel like as comfortable teaching creatively, how do we foster creativity into our classes for our students who maybe don't feel that creative, or they're like, oh, I don't have this skill. So then what do we do?
I actually did a whole like online hour workshop on this, because what a good question, right? It's called Scaffolding Creativity. People should go check it out. If you hear this podcast, go check out that workshop, because I'm just going to say the same things here. I think before I say the things that are my responses, I want to just toss one of the balls back to you to hear how you answer the question. How do you frame the difference between variability and creativity? Because they're different words, so they must be different. But how do you frame that difference?
Ooh, I like it. It's a good question. To me, variability is something that I can opt into, but is also being placed upon me regardless of whether I choose variability or not. I can show up at the gym really, really tired, and maybe I'm working on some beats or something. And because I'm more tired, I generate less velocity, so I use a different pathway than I would otherwise. Creativity is something that, to me, you have to make space for. You can't just show up and do things without at least having a mindset or an approach that fosters it. So it's something that requires a little bit more personal input than just the variability of context and environment and time.
So if I was going to reflect an example back to you, if you went in to train and you were feeling very tired and low one day, then that would be variability. And if you went in on a day when you were feeling quite good and strong and pretended that you were quite tired or quite low and decided, with my really good strong day, I'm going to do an imitation of my low day. I'm going to have an easy day, not because I need it, but because it's a creative exercise. Then that would be creativity. There's a degree of intentionality that creates the difference between these things. So then let's flip that distinction a little bit. It's because it sounds a little bit like we're coming towards a square and a rectangle, you know, that creativity requires variability, but that variability doesn't require creativity in how you conceive of them.
I would say so. Yeah. Like you can do a bench press and have 400 different movement patterns in a bench press. I don't think I would ever consider a bench press to be a creative exercise, unless you're bench pressing as if you're really tired, but you're not, and you're doing it for some like bodybuilder circus act, in which case it can be.
Right. And so there's something about the process or the intentionality that creates the thing. Okay, so I'll answer the question from kind of like a more researchy perspective. So there is a fascinating kind of dichotomy between two sets of researchers. One of them is, I want to say Runko and Jaeger have the standard definition of creativity, which is that it creates things, artifacts, that are novel and valuable. Now, novelty, in their kind of ongoing description of it, right, can mean a whole lot of different things, but is fairly well defined, right? Can be defined more objectively than something like value, which they say this definition doesn't say anything about what value is or who creates value. We just acknowledge that a part of the creative artifact, that the way we judge something to be creative or not creative, is on whether or not it is novel or original, and whether or not it is valuable, right? Something can certainly be novel and original, but have no value. And again, they say that value can be determined by anyone, you know? When I have a five-year-old go upside down and sling for the very first time, right? What they're doing is certainly novel, right? But whether or not it is ascribed value is a subjective, cultural, social set of interactions, right? Whether or not the six-year-old turns upside down for the first time and I celebrate, or I say, now straighten your legs, is part of the process by which value is being ascribed to that thing, right? So when you perform a switch from meat hook to back flag, right, are you doing something novel? Well, in 2008, you were definitely doing something novel, right? That was like top of the line novel skill in 2008, you know, like pirouettes on rope. Were you doing something novel when you did a pirouette on rope in 2007? Yes, you were. It was very novel, right? And circus is such an interesting environment to look at creativity in, because circus literally values novelty. Because if you are doing something new that no one has done before, that is how we, one of the ways, but certainly probably a primary way that we determine value in circus, which is why circus is seen outside of the community as like one of these incredible founts of creativity, you know? The other set of researchers that talk about creativity that I also really enjoy, Glavino and Baghetto, have what they call the non-standard definition of creativity. And this acknowledges the standard definition and its focus on the creation of an artifact and its focus on outcome, but says we need to recognize that our focus on outcome in talking about how we define creativity is necessary but insufficient. That a creative process can occur whether or not a creative artifact is ever seen, right? They talk about how creativity can be seen or framed as a novel person world experience that has a set of characteristics, right? They have a whole little list of characteristics. I won't go through each of them, you know, exhaustively, but like, for example, one of their characteristics is that a creative experience is open-ended, that in order for an experience to be creative, in order for a novel person-world encounter to be creative, we need to not know where it's going to end. There needs to not be a prescribed outcome to it as just one of their characteristics, you know? And so I think these ways of thinking about creativity are really interesting to apply to circus, right? And to think about both how we teach and how we've learned and the sort of work that we hope to create in the world, right? And I think, you know, I don't know, I always feel a little big-headed when I'm like, circus can change the world, but I do think that circus can change the world, so, you know, maybe it's not me personally who's going to do it, it is all of us, right? What do we want to propagate? Which ideas do we want to propagate into the world?
For those two definitions of creativity, the one that resonated a little bit more with me was the latter one, where there's some amount of, like, world person experience, and if we look at the first one, I didn't really plan to bring up AI in this conversation, but it seems like it just works its way into everything these days. If I tell ChatGPT to make something, it can make something new and it can make something of value. Is ChatGPT being creative? Some might say yes. For some of us, that would be an uncomfortable, like, I don't know, it's just a computer program. And then you get into the whole deterministic, like, if you can look at someone's brain and all the inputs and outputs, you can predict all their behavior. Anyway, but with everything that you said, going back to that toddler or that five-year-old inverting, can we introduce creativity, whichever definition we're comfortable with, from day one? Can we? And how do we do that while still being as safe as possible, or as safe as quote unquote necessary? Because I think as safe as possible is maybe too safe sometimes.
Yeah, I was going to say as safe as possible is like stay home, don't come to circus, right? It's the Finding Nemo lesson, right? He's never going to do anything. I do think we introduce creativity from day one. Now, do we introduce expressive movement from day one? Probably not, right? And we need to draw a really bright line between these things. I think sometimes when people hear me talk about creativity and introducing creativity, they think I mean, you know, I want my day one sling student to pretend that they're an astronaut or to go through, you know, like their childhood traumas as they're at their first sling class. Like, No, there are certain social expectations, right, that are there and that we should observe, right? We don't need to completely upend what our students' expectations of their class are going to be or what our expectations are, or necessarily push back against all of the social pressures that have created a really, like, thriving, you know, aerial and circus recreational scene in the United States. I don't need to change all of that, right? But how we talked about earlier that variability and creativity are really just squares and rectangles, right? That variability is necessary for creativity, right? Because it is, and that's, I find that hard to dispute, right? I feel like anyone would find that hard to dispute, but maybe we could find someone. So if variability is necessary, if it's a necessary prerequisite for creativity, then we need to introduce variability on day one. Sling class one, trapeze class one, juggling class one. I need to introduce variability, right? Here is how we go from sitting to standing on the trapeze. Here's another way we go from sitting to standing on the trapeze. Can you go from sitting to standing in a way that's all your own on the trapeze, right? That is basically my hour-long intro to trapeze class, right? The trapezes are hung 3 feet from the floor with crash mats underneath so everyone can just sit directly on the trapeze. We don't have to go from under the bar to on top of the bar on day one, right? What do we do in day one of sling class? Basically the same thing, right? Can you go from sitting to standing? Here's a way to do that. Way A. Here's way B, right? Ooh, there's a mix of way A and way B. Can you do way B with only one leg? Can you come up with way C? Installing from the very, very first day at any age that what the student can create to solve the task problem is more valuable to me than their ability to execute the thing that I'm teaching them. From day one. Absolutely.
I love that. That also, one of the first people that I had traveled and taught workshops with was Cody Heyman. He and I taught in the Southeast for a little while, like a, I don't know, 2 week road trip. And one of the workshops that he kept teaching was, I think, called Go Your Own Way, or maybe even You Can Go Your Own Way. And it was literally like a series of movement puzzles of like, how can you solve this task? Here's point A, here's point B, figure it out. And that style, obviously, people could say, well, you know, I want more scaffolding, I need more instruction, maybe it's not comfortable for them, or on trapeze a little bit easier than on rope, depending on what the point A and point B are. But in all of that, you're giving someone that nugget, like you said, of, hey, how you solve this task matters more than the idealized template of how you should solve this task. And then we get into, over the pandemic, a lot of people creating new skills, new movements on different apparatus, even on straps, which a lot of people are like, you can't be creative on straps. And some of what happens is you have a happy accident, there's variability, and then you can extract is the wrong word, but you can like build off of that happy accident and create something new.
Yeah, it's been fun over the past, I think specifically 5 years, to watch straps really sort of explode its own variability. I think I saw it start with actually kind of a rigging change that happened, which is the straps actually started to have different size loops, right? That they became really adjustable in terms of like how big the loop could be. Can I get my strap all the way up to, say, my elbow, right? So that I can do some of this stuff. Can I tuck it into my armpit? Can I do these different things? And we saw like the literal technical innovation in straps start to explode. In my mind, I'm not as strappy as you are. So in my mind, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, like a couple years pre-pandemic, we were seeing that sort of innovation start to happen. And for some reason, people don't think that's creativity, right? In creativity, we would call that art bias, that people associate creativity with expressive movement or with their own conceptions of like what capital A art would be. Or, you know, like in gymnastics case, how many gymnasts have been told they aren't creative, right? When what someone meant to say is you aren't expressive, right? And what someone meant to say by that is like the expression that you do have doesn't fit in the cultural narrative of what it means to be expressive, right? Like dance has really well-developed expressive languages, right? When I dance in this way, it means I am expressing ABC. Whether or not it feels like that to the dancer is almost irrelevant to like the vast amount of work that's been created that tells us how to interpret, that gatekeeps the interpretation of dance from a lot of people, right? That limits what we mean by creativity or limits what we mean by expressive movement to XYZ things, you know? And I think it is past time to just like blow the frickin' hinges off of all of those doors, right? Creativity doesn't mean that. Creativity means, can I do dislocks, you know, from my armpits, you know? It's been fascinating to watch straps in particular. Also, to be a little removed from that research process, because it was not my discipline.
Honestly, as much as I am thrilled for the creative development of those movements, they are so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable. And
right.
And then I don't necessarily want to get into all of that, but like, at what point are we doing straps anymore? Like, why are we dividing skills by apparatus? Because after a certain point, like, you put some safeties on two slings and rig them close together. Like, is it sling? Is it straps? Like, what's going on? But one thing I think I did want to get your take on before we run out of time, what happens? Do we make things less safe when we add creativity, when we add variability?
I mean, we make things riskier when we make things riskier, you know? Adding creativity, adding variability can be way riskier. But limiting variability and limiting creativity can also be way riskier, right? We have to begin to account for psychological damage. We have to begin to account for cultural damage. We have to begin to account for inclusivity. We have to begin to account for a more holistic sense of what we mean when we say something becomes riskier or less risky, right? The risk, for example, of let's say teaching an inversion on silks in a certain way, right? A risk of teaching a really particular version of inversions on silk is that someone who has really big boobs won't be able to do it because their boobs are in the way, right? And by saying it has to be done this way, right? One of the risks I create is that this person with really big boobs will go, oh, I guess this isn't for me. And the world will have lost an artist. You know, I remember back when I was starting, and I'm glad we've gotten over this, but it was, you know, nigh on 10 years ago, the like, if a, one of the beginner level skills on trapeze was tucking with your knees together under the bar, right? Yeah. And now everyone rolls their eyes, right? Now everyone goes, well, of course you don't have to do it that way. But like, no, come on, guys. We were all committed to that. I didn't teach trapeze, so I wasn't, but I was in other ways, right? I was in that camp too, right? And we have to recognize what the balance of risks, of physical, psychological, social risks are. And we have to do a better job of balancing all of those risks, right? Because whether or not we're engaging in real risk assessment, not performative risk assessment, but real risk assessment, yes, if I ask a student to, you know, create their own drop on fabric and they're not ready to do that, is that riskier than just teaching them a drop? Absolutely. Of course that's riskier, right? I'm not asking people to discard their common sense. It's like, yeah, but teaching someone that a double star can only be done with their legs in this one position, straight legs, straddle, pike. For some people, that position will be more dangerous. For some people, let's say bendier people, right? Man, if I tell them to pike and straddle as far and as wide as they can, I am increasing the chance that that top foot is going to clip the post. But by not going through the process of what does this person's body look like, by not actually doing a risk assessment, I am increasing risk. So can incorporating variability increase risk? Of course, right? But it can also reduce risk. So incorporating variability and incorporating creativity is a tool, and it can be used in both directions, just like a failure to incorporate variability, right, can either increase or decrease risk. These are both just sliders on the scale of how we're interacting with our students.
100%. While you were talking about that, I was thinking, if you are never exposed to a different way of, let's say, holding a side planche, back flag, reverse meat hook, whatever you want to call it, you might be taught the only way to hold this is with a bent arm. And holding it with a bent arm aggravates your elbow for many number of potential reasons. But if you're shown, hey, you can hold this with a bent arm or a straight arm, I'm going to make this easy and approachable enough that you can change those variables and some other variables. Now what feels better, what is easier to hold, then you've gotten variability that allowed you to lower the risk of finding something painful or uncomfortable, and you built a broader solution space for something like catching a top switch.
Yes, and I think the thing you just said is key, which is that variability allows us to broaden solution spaces, right? And I think the thing that I'd be interested in promoting is the stage at which we incorporate variability for students. For me, and from my like informal, you know, 7-year laboratory practice, from day one, and then again on day two, and then again on day three, and then again on day four. And what that leads to for people who are then interested in like top level performance, what that leads to is top level performers who can invent their own material without having to go all the way back to the beginning and train that muscle from the start again, right? In a way, a lot of my pedagogical approach and a lot of my thoughts actually came from my work with like high level elite artists who I was like, let's make something up, right? They were like, I don't even know what that means. I don't even know how to do what you're talking about, right? And so I was like, oh, somewhere along the way in elite level training, we are failing these young artists and athletes, right? And oh, look, the solution that will serve that very small population that is interested in and able to get to like elite level international national performance, the thing that's going to serve them coincidentally is also better for everyone. I really push back against the idea that it's like, oh, this is all fine and good for recreational folks, but I'm really serious. The idea that really serious artists or athletes should be doing something different than that should go the way of the dodo. It's an old idea that shouldn't exist anymore, that we need to be vocal about pushing back against. There's not a moment where your training, quote unquote, gets real. There's just a moment where you start training more, where the load increases, where the hours per day that you can spend doing the thing goes from 3 a week, 5 a week, to 5 a day, you know? And that's, you know, that's the only difference that we should be seeing here.
There is this idea that you cannot, and this has been talked about a lot, so we don't have to hash through the whole thing, but that you can't make a straps act, as an example, without every switch in it and a full twist and et cetera, et cetera. And you'll have people who are incredibly physically skilled who have not practiced and developed the skill of being creative at all and haven't made an act but want to perform and are holding back on working on the literal skill of creativity and expression and art, capital A, because they're like, I have to collect all my skills first. And once I have them, then I can be serious.
I think of it as, because you have to rehab. You have to rehab those people. You have to rehab them gently. You have to meet those people where they're at and rehab them gently into like a different conception of what it means to engage with making performative work. Now, I think that the key distinction that I would want to make in what you were just saying is, you know, I can't make an act until I have every switch. I can't make an act until I do this thing. No, you might not get hired until XYZ, right? The criteria that the professional industry uses to hire artists for shows, right, is entirely different. And we have to simultaneously acknowledge that it exists and push back against it, right? The criteria that casting directors use to hire straps artists, hand balancers, right? Those criteria absolutely need to change. That's a different episode, right? But the criteria that the professional industry uses for hiring or that professional schools use for auditioning is an entirely different question than can you make an act, right? I have, you know, 11-year-olds make strap acts and they have a skin the cat. Like that's their highest level skill. Can they make an act? Yes. Can that act be amazing and emotionally affecting? Absolutely it can be. Can it be expressive? Absolutely it can be. Because as soon as we concede that skill is the only thing we're showcasing, right? Then we're in sports.
And even if we're in sports, you are still going to benefit from training variability. You are still going to benefit from developing creative problem. This is in air quotes for people who do not get to see me doing this, but a creative problem-solving approach for solving the task goal, whatever it is, whether it's bouncing on your hands or going from a meat hook to a reverse meat hook or whatever. You, even in sports, you have that.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the criteria that people's eyes go to the most, you know? How fast are you? How smooth are you? How slow are you? How da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Training those, even just technical characteristics from the start, are important, you know? Because the distinction between technical variability and expressive variability is not much. It's been so gate kept by quote unquote art, by the cultural hierarchy that exists through kind of education and professional performance that protects the sacred artist, the expressiveness of the jibba. You have to be having a real experience. You have to blah blah blah. Art is so sacred. Blah blah blah. No, 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 no. It's all bunk. It's all bunk, right?
But it's real. It's real that it impacts people. Like I genuinely, when I was younger in my career and I was still performing, now I don't really perform anymore, I performed with the socialized mindset that I was an athlete performing skills because I had internalized this cultural mentality of I don't have something deep and emotional to express. Therefore, I am not expressing on stage. I am just showing these cool skills. And that's rough. Like, it could have been different.
Yeah. What a beautiful and personal, like, articulation of the way that these larger systems influence your relationship with all of your technique, your relationship with straps, your relationship with those skills themselves, right? That the story you told yourself, right? Because the story you told yourself didn't come from nowhere. It's not like you just decided that's who you were, who you're going to be. You received messages. We decide who we are based on the messages we receive from the world around us, right? And I think that coaches have a responsibility to use our disproportionate social influence with our students to send certain countercultural messages. And that's what I'm trying to put out there, right? The student might not hear it from us. They might not be ready for it yet, but I have the responsibility to use my disproportionate social influence to push certain countercultural messages.
So this segues well into our last little question, but social media, I think, has done a lot of incredible things for circus. It's mainstreamified it. It's really pushed the belief that people can achieve even more and more insane things with their bodies. And not in all spaces, but in a lot of spaces, it's reinforced unfortunate ideals about body image, about ableism, all sorts of different types of privilege. So can we use social media as a tool that saves culture, that educates people, and that generally, like you said, pushes some of those countercultural messages without theoretically losing some of that eye-catchy goodness that people are drawn to in the social media space?
We could. Yes, we could. We could try. Will we? And will the algorithms let us, you know? Like, I think that, you know, you were talking about AI earlier, and I think that social media gets also a little talked to death in a way, because I think that the effect that social media has on the real world is simultaneously profound and a little overblown. I, the coach in the space who is there with my student, even if I'm working with them online, even if I'm not physically present with them, the person who I'm communicating with, I have more influence than social media does over that person, right? And so, you know, I work with teenagers through my whole career because teenagehood from 11 to 16 is a really exciting period to work with young athletes, right? If you ever have a chance to like start at 11 and move someone through to 18, man, that is an exciting 7 years where some of them just like literally go on natural steroids and you're like, whoa, what happened to your body? It's unbelievable, right? But you have more influence than social media on any of your students, right? Because you're the one who can say, wow, it looks like you're talking to yourself really poorly. Is that because you're comparing yourself to the video you saw on Instagram, right? You can tell a story about a relationship to social media. You can tell a story about the appropriate relationship of social media to a person, right? We, the coaching community, can do a better job of showing what it looks like to learn a skill, right? Of showing what variability looks like, what creativity looks like, what expressive movement looks like, how these things get put out into the world. We can do better at that. I'm not saying we're not doing it. I'm saying we can do better at it. I'm saying we can do it more, right? The problem becomes how social media picks up and propagates. Like what are the things that are out of our control? The literal algorithmic things. Like if social media will show you know, this video to 10,000 people and this video to 4 people, we can't help that, you know? We can do a good job as coaches or as people on social media. Like, there are things that I think are emerging as, like, responsible social media citizenship, you know? Like, whenever I see a fat person lifting weights, I repost, right? Whenever I see a beautiful non-traditional body type doing a circus discipline, I repost, right? I like, I comment, I repost. I think of this as part of my good citizenship in these spaces, right? Whenever I see a post that questions the narratives that I want to question, I repost, I like, I comment. I do all the things I can do to promote the visuals that I'm interested in seeing. I have a fun sidebar story. I don't know if this will make your cut or not. But here's my fun sidebar story. There was a period of time, I'd say from like 2015 to 2020, where a lot of aerial and pole competitions were trying to get off the ground, you know? And I had opinions. I had opinions about this, you know? I do still have opinions. I have opinions about most things, though. And so I took my opinions to be a judge at these things, right? Like, I think Viva Fest is still going. I've been a judge at Viva Fest for 2 or 3 years. I haven't gone since COVID, but pre-COVID, I was a judge at Viva Fest for a few years. I was a judge for some of these aerial and pole competitions. And I went because I wanted to have some influence. I wanted to try to exert social influence over what these competitions were promoting, right? What the scoring structure of these competitions looked like, what some of the comments that judges, what the interaction between judges and artists would or should look like. I wanted to exert influence over those things, right? And so I you know, kind of tried to leverage my resume and leverage my presence in some of these communities to like get on these judgeships so that I could be in that room so I could have those conversations, because a lot of people are really motivated by these competitions. Like, pole fitness has built its entire industry, its entire presence off of the fact that people enjoy these competitions. And they do. I'm not here to take competition away from people, but I am here to say, like, what do I as a coach value in community, right? What do we value in community? And how are those things reflected in, say, the scoring rubric that we're going to use for this competition, right? Whether or not this competition is going to have a winner and like what that winner is going to look like, right? Are there adjunct prizes that we can give to promote certain things, right? So here's a first place person, but is there a prize for innovation, right? What is that prize, you know? Because those are the sorts of influences that I think we want to have and that we need to propagate through the industry.
I mean, I'm just thinking about if you take the same rubric and structure that are often applied at like circus and pole competitions, and you apply it to a visual art competition, you're like, oh yes, in this painting, you used a light brush stroke 3 times. So therefore, we're going to give you a little bit more. Like, that's fucking never going to happen. It would be absurd. Like, it makes no sense. Right. And obviously, physical disciplines have an element of athleticism. So we're more primed to accept that there are almost like trick-based judgments and like, oh, you did XYZ skill. But if someone was like, oh yeah, I went to a poetry slam and they told me I didn't do enough alliteration, so I didn't pass. Like, that's clearly like, that would make no sense.
Right, it's nonsensical. Right, it makes no sense, right? And I think what is beautiful about circus is the level of physical achievement. I'm not trying to take the skill out of circus, right? I'm trying to have fewer people who follow recipes and more people who are chefs, right? More people who understand kind of what's underlying both performance and just recreationalism, you know, like, and just a vocational straps training. This is why, for me, circus is both a performing and expressive art, right? I'll call that like oh man, I had such a good name for it 12 seconds ago in my head. Anyway, there's kind of the part of circus that is about an audience, that is about communicating something, that's about making something for other people, that says something about the world or expresses something about yourself. But equally important, if not more important, is like the way that circus can be a journey of the self. The way that it's okay if you want to just make high-level skills and never put together an act, then do that. If you want to make beautiful acts, beautiful skill reels on Instagram, and that's your art, that's fine. That's a beautiful journey of the self. You just can't reconcile that with wanting to work for Cirque du Soleil.
Sure. And if you just want to do circus because it's fun and your friends do it, then do that. Like, but just going back to our original past and history at Circus Warehouse, that was, I would say, right before Instagram like really took off. And at that point in time, social media, I had a Facebook, that was it, whatever. But at no point was I getting information from the rest of the world about like, oh, here's why and how you should do circus. It was like, I'm doing circus because I enjoy it. I'm moving my body in ways that feel good. And it's with people I like. And the instructors are mostly nice. But there are so many journeys of why we do circus. And those are all valuable and acceptable. But like you said, some prepare you for X endpoint in a certain way, and some don't, and that's fine.
Yeah. 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 And I think that the thing you just said that I would reflect back and just punch up as hard as I can is that no one was telling you how to circus. And it feels sometimes now like between professional performance and Instagram and like blah, 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 and the world that people are telling you how to circus, right? And I just want to see more coaches, because that message doesn't come from nowhere, right? I'm not telling you how to circus, right? I'm trying to fight for the idea that like, circus can look, the point of circus, the thing that makes circus circus, is that you should do it your way, right? And that we as coaches, as circus coaches, maybe that's the way to say it, as a circus coach, not as a handstand coach, not as a juggling coach, not as a straps coach, but if circus is the thing that I'm trying to teach and coach, then there's something there that is worth preserving, that is necessary to preserve, and it is about and around variability and creativity as a tool, not only for like personal development and expression, but also for motor development, also for psychological development, also for social development. It is all about variability and creativity. It all comes back to the way that those things interweave with each other.
Well summarized. I would agree. Like you said, at a certain point in time, there weren't people telling us how to make circus. You had people randomly gathering in San Francisco to then form Seven Fingers, and they weren't getting Instagram reels of XYZ. I made a duo straps act with a blow-up doll because my duo partner couldn't come because she was doing her PhD. And I was like, well, I need to do duo, so this is a comedy act. And honestly, I was probably more comfortable performing that act then I would be now. Because you'd be like, oh, well, you weren't doing as many high-level tricks back then.
The expectations have been set differently. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, thank you. I would say the main thrust that I took away from this is variability is going to be introduced from day one to your training. Creativity is something that, as coaches, if you're listening as a coach, it's probably beneficial to start training as a skill from day one. And if you're listening as a learner, figure out how to do things your own way that feels safe and incorporate the feedback from coaching. But if something feels better and more comfortable and easier, that doesn't mean that it's wrong if it's not a perfect idealized straight line handstand or straddle inversion. And otherwise, in general, check out Adam's courses online. He has a lot of them. And as far as I'm aware, they're all sliding scale? Question mark?
Maybe? Yeah, I can plug them. Yeah. My personal revolt against capitalism is you can get all of my work for free. It's not an application or anything. You just go to all my courses and you just pick the price that sings to your heart. And that's the price for all of my work. If you want to work with me individually, I do online consults or lessons, both with coaches and with studios and with students. So if you're interested in any of those things, that's all there too. In March, I'm not sure when this episode will come out, but in March, for 4 Fridays in March, I'm leading a live cohort on like unpacking nonlinear pedagogy and working it into your teaching. Nonlinear pedagogy is task constraint based approaches. So if you are interested in like, what does non-traditional teaching look like actually? And you want kind of a 4-week guided journey into like, I just want to change like one small thing in my teaching and then maybe one more small thing. Join me for the month of March for that. And then all the rest of my online courses are just online for pay what you can, click the price you want to have. And, you know, if you've got lots of money, then pay some more. And if you don't have much money, then pay some less.
Sweet. Yeah. Thank you so much, Adam. It's been a pleasure. I am excited to ponder all of what we discussed and continue trying to think about how I can incorporate it better into my own coaching. And I'm sure that by the time I've done that, you'll say something else that will provoke me to reconsider something else that I'm doing that I could be doing better. And that's fine. And that's why I really love and appreciate these conversations. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's been a pleasure and I always enjoy seeing your work.